Hello and welcome to the Cannabis Corner. I am your host, Joshua Braff, and I'm here with my partner, farmer Adam Teitelbaum. Today we have a very special show. We have Amy Villela, who is an activist and a progressive running for Congress in Nevada's 4th District, and will talk to us about her most pressing thoughts on how to improve healthcare and discuss how she came to be an advocate for the people of Nevada. We also have Sarah Payan, who's the public education officer at the Apothecarium in San Francisco, a very, very special dispensary that we will discuss. We also have Danielle Schumacher. Danielle's been in the game since 01, 04, working very hard as an activist in cannabis. That means a great deal. Danielle co-founded chapters of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. We've all heard about NORML and discussed it, capital N-O-R-M-L. And while she was still in school, she was appointed executive director of Illinois NORML and the first chancellor of Oaksterdam University. She currently works with Dr. Frank Lucido, a very important guest of ours out of Berkeley. He's been discussing cannabis as medicine longer than most people. So I want to welcome you, and I would love to also ask you first, Amy Villela, tell us about running for Congress. You have recently put yourself on the ballot, and I thought maybe you'd tell us and our viewers how you came to make this decision, and at what point in your life did cannabis come into your world to the extent that you decided to run by saying, I am an advocate of this as medicine?
Sure. So I am not your typical career politician. You know, I was raised in poverty after my parents divorced. And then as a single mother myself, I struggled like many Americans do in poverty. You know, I was on Medicaid, I was on WIC, on food stamps, and I bring a real unique mix to Congress because I've also been a CFO, worked with children with disabilities, and especially children that are in need of severe assistance. But my entry into activism came on the wake of my daughter's death. You know, I had gone through the struggle of being a single mom and worked my way through college and finally, you know, got the first in my family to get a degree. And I married my husband, who is from Brazil, but also a pilot. And, you know, here we thought we were finally at that point where, you know, living that American dream. I'm able to get back to my children and finally, you know, have some security in life, or so I thought. Unfortunately, my daughter passed away because she could not provide proof of insurance from a very preventable illness. She had a blood clot and went to a local ER and was told straight up that you need to go get insurance and see a specialist because we're not a doctor's office, even though that she had arrived with every symptom and risk factor, essentially, of a blood clot with a red swollen leg. And, you know, like many Americans, I didn't think this happens in this country, but it does. And the more that I got into the community, the more that I started remembering where I'd come from and what was happening and seeing that we are now a country that the top 10% of our wealth, the top 10% of our families have 75% of the wealth in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's only getting worse and that this disparity is growing. And it all started to come full circle for me. And I will tell you, the moment that my daughter died in my arms and I was holding her, and looking, and as she was dying, I was telling her, you will not have died in vain. That was that pivotal moment in my life where it really hit me that we are only as strong in this country as our weakest and most vulnerable. And we have to be each other's keepers. We have to make sure that we are passing legislation and doing things that are in the best interest of the people and not the donors. And the more I started researching and going out there and looking and becoming involved, the more that it became apparent that that's not what was happening. We have a lot of representation that is not so interested as much as how their legislation they're passing affects the people in this country, but how it's going to line the pockets of their wealthy donors. And it was time to do something.
So this experience, which sounds so awful and so many people can either relate or empathize, had you in a hospital receiving news from the physicians, from the administration, that you didn't have the appropriate paperwork to get the appropriate medical attention for your daughter? In this period of time, was this a week long? Was this over 48 hours?
So my daughter was 22, and she moved out to live with us in Las Vegas. You know, can't imagine why a young woman would want to live in Las Vegas, right?
Right. Nothing to do there.
So she drove herself from Kansas City to Las Vegas. When she arrived here, I had to leave to go out of town for a business meeting. So I was not with my daughter in the emergency room. And again, she was an adult. Mm-hmm. And she felt like the last day of her job in Kansas City was the last day of her insurance. I would have known better as, you know, being a CFO, but I was out of town. Mm-hmm. And so Shalyn went to the ER actually with my husband, and they were calling me from the ER asking me about insurance, and the hospital was saying, well, it's going to be very expensive. You can leave now. And Shalyn's like, no, there's something really wrong. They were having my husband call up the insurance company to try to see if they couldn't get her on the insurance. And I'm like, guys, don't worry about the insurance right now. Just take care of this. And if you have to pay for it, we'll pay for it. You know, at that point, I'm just like, why are you even calling me with this? I just couldn't understand why this was even a topic of discussion when you're sitting there crying and 8 out of 10 pain. And obviously something's wrong with your leg. Mm-hmm. And it's just been getting increasingly worse since she arrived. And so, unfortunately, I was not there and able to advocate for my daughter. And, you know, there's so many young people out there that don't know the ins and outs of insurance. It is so complicated. And when people come back and say, well, you know, she should have understood the insurance. Look, ignorance should not be a death sentence. And this country has really gone away from its humanity and the way we treat our fellow man in this country. And that really, again, that was just the thing that really was the takeaway out of this whole experience, was that, you know, right now we are losing our working class. We are losing sight on taking care of our neighbors and each other. And it's becoming a race to become wealthy and to just talk about money in concrete terms. And no one deserves to have a death sentence because they're poor or because they have mental illness or because they couldn't afford to have cancer. No one deserves a death sentence for that. And that is something I am adamant about, that we have to take care of people, basic necessities of life. I believe it's a human right to have a life and to be able to get care, basic care. I mean, this is something to me that's a no-brainer.
Well, I really appreciate you telling this story, and it sounds like you're going to go around the country and speak about this. And anyone who's ever had a child or had a cousin or a sibling or a friend is touched by what occurred, and what a horror. It's not hard for us these days to think about the government not necessarily being on our side, not necessarily looking out for the betterment of man. But yes, you're right. That dollar sign, that very powerful sign, you can't turn on the news and not get a sense that a certain feeling from the Conservative Party or the Republican Party does suggest you're going to have to make it on your own. This is about have and have nots. We don't do it the way Canada does it. We don't care how mm-hmm. the Netherlands do it. And so part of what Sarah and Danielle and myself and Adam think about a lot is the elderly and people who are ill, and definitely people who are poor and people who are of color in New Jersey and other states yep. that can't get out of prison, even, you know, for getting busted with 3 pounds of weed in 01 or whatever. So this all needs to be opened up. Amy, you have said that you are pro cannabis as medicine. How does, where's the bridge from universal Medicare to that happening? And then I was thinking about having Sarah weigh in on how she approached it and what year.
Sure.
And, yeah.
First of all, we need to legalize cannabis so that we can actually fund research. I am definitely a huge proponent of that. Again, working in a nonprofit industry that was primarily taking care of individuals that were ill and in pain, and many people that wanted to use alternative methods to deal with that pain, it became very apparent to me that we are right now at the mercy of the big pharmaceutical companies. And boy, do they pour a lot of money into elections and politics, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is part of my platform, is making sure that, you know, reason why I'm not taking corporate PAC money is because I want to be beholden to the people. Right now, we need to put research into this. Again, anyone suffering or dying needlessly, one death, one person suffering needlessly is one too many. We have to be moving forward to make sure that we are exploring every possibility and making sure that we are not criminalizing people and putting them in jail for longer sentences than violent offenders. Part of my platform is I want to reform the criminal justice system. I want to get people out of jail or in there because they for nonviolent drug offenses with cannabis. That's ridiculous. And we need to wipe the record clean and ban the box. We need to give people the opportunity to have a life and to be able to be productive. It's ridiculous the amount of money we're spending, as well as the inhumanity of keeping people in prison for insane long sentences for cannabis.
Right. There's so much to be said about this meshing of civil rights and people's freedoms and an enormous and growing elderly community that should have access to cheaper even and better medicines than perhaps what's been prescribed generation after generation.
Most definitely.
Yes, go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think one of the hardest things is that it's incredibly expensive to be ill. Even when you have a job waiting for you when you're done and you have insurance, it's still stressful. And my most critically ill patients are on fixed incomes. And it's horrible. It's really stressful. And the fact that they have cheaper access to opiates and benzos, which cause a lot of problems, than they do to cannabis is horrible. And through my job as one of the chairs of the legalization task force for San Francisco, we've been talking this year a lot about compassion programs, both on a local and state level, and going to Sacramento and talking about then pushing what needs to be happening. I mean, it's not a crime to be sick.
And so many are feeling so pressed by it and want to also assuage their doctors who are saying, trust me, this is the thing I want to give you. But it's in national news that it is a good idea to perhaps question your doctor in ways that people haven't in the past. But all the while, this stigma needs to rise for people who generationally can't see themselves do it. I currently have a father who I've been mentioning who begins chemo today. In his whole life, he was not sick, and at 83, he finds himself with stage 4 liver cancer and zero appetite, and his weight is just dropping. And he says to me, I can't eat if I'm not hungry. It's almost as if it's after Thanksgiving dinner and I'm sitting on the couch. So very serious stuff here that we're discussing on this particular day, because all of us here have seen what happens to human beings as they age and when they get ill. And we should feel good about ourselves, creating an energy and emotion toward an idea that says, I am me and I can choose what works for me. And if it works for me, then so be it. Danielle Schumacher, you work with Dr. Lucido. Last time we spoke, you had been talking about the kind of people you see in the office most. Has that changed at all with recreational legality in California? Are you seeing more people? Are you seeing more teenagers? Are parents saying, you know what, I don't want to put them on antidepressants. I'd like to either first try a vitamin D pill. That's even before CBD. Thoughts there?
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit since Prop 64 passed, and then especially January 1st when adult sales went into effect in California. So Dr. Lucido and also nurse practitioner Maria Mangini, they're based in Berkeley. They've been doing the cannabis consultations for over 20 years, so longer than I think there's just maybe a few other doctors still practicing who've been doing it as long as Frank Lucido. And it's always shifting.
Yeah.
So I've been there almost 10 years now.
Okay.
And as of January 1st, the most noticeable shift is a lot of people don't know what to do about the teenagers, because if you're between 18 and 21 years old, you're in a bit of a gray area legally. You still need to be a patient. But of course, a lot of the people that are 18 to 21 or a little younger, just maybe 16, 17, they think it's legal.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So we haven't seen a lot of new teenagers coming in yet. But we have received a lot of questions about that for various reasons. You know, anything that an adult treats, a teenager could be treating. And then, of course, as you mentioned, just over prescribing pharmaceuticals, because that's all a lot of doctors have time to do is prescribe a pill and move on. We've seen a huge increase in kids, families that have been hearing about it, thinking about it. And now that adult sales are in effect, they just feel empowered to finally try it. I think part of that is that doctors feel empowered to finally be able to talk to their patient about it instead of saying, I don't know anything about that. I can't really talk to you about that. And I need to move on. They're starting to say something. Right. Some of them are still not on board, mm-hmm. but we're still receiving a lot of referrals from other doctors, particularly from pain management doctors mm-hmm. and any doctor who sees elderly patients. So when someone's got something that's inoperable, or maybe it's a veteran who just is really insisting, I want to be able to use cannabis. And then, of course, the pain management doctors, because they've tried everything. They've prescribed everything they can possibly prescribe for these people. And either it's not working or the patient no longer wants to keep trying pharmaceuticals. So huge increase in the number of elderly people who are finally ready to at least talk to the doctor about it. And their family comes with them. They come from all over the place because we can do video appointments now. So people in other states, for instance, New Jersey, where there's some law, but they don't know exactly how to access it, or they already have their family members done the research and realized, okay, yes, there's a law in place, you know, in over 25 states now.
Right.
But most of those states, it's really complicated to obtain. And even if they can figure out how to obtain it, there's no doctor who knows enough about it to make them feel comfortable to try it. So we spend, in addition to the doctor and the nurse practitioner, our other support staff, we spend a lot of time walking people through the process of how cannabis may or may not help and how to access it, not only in California, because it's even gotten complicated for patients in California. A lot of what we're hearing is our current patients who are going to every dispensary that they can access, realistically access geographically, mm-hmm. and they're all out of the tinctures and they're mm-hmm. all out of the edibles. And a lot of the dispensaries are no longer stocking the medical products for various reasons. So it's shifting really quickly in a good way, though, that more and more patients are willing to try it. And also cancer. There's people with all different kinds of cancer and health insurance situations, and so they need help navigating their options. And I wanted to mention that a bridge between the medical cannabis and health care reform in general, Dr. Lucido stopped accepting insurance about 10 years ago for his primary care. So we still have a primary care practice. He's been doing primary care since the 70s in Berkeley, almost 40 years now. And he used to be a hospital doctor and see firsthand the difference between someone with insurance and someone without. And we all know the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, didn't change much about that. It just created a lot more paperwork and complicated back and forth between the doctors, the insurance, and the family. So we stopped accepting insurance 10 years ago because we didn't want to be part of that problem anymore. And we want to do honest, straightforward, direct primary care and spend our time doing what the patient actually needs mm-hmm. instead of what the insurance company will cover. And all of that happens through coding. You code everything and then it gets processed and covered or not. We don't participate in that game anymore. He can see patients who can afford to pay a flat rate out of pocket, and it's not affordable for everybody, but we're one doctor, one nurse practitioner. It's spreading through the Bay Area. Several doctor's offices heard about what we were doing and have designed their practice inspired by what we're doing in Berkeley. And there's actually a national database now called, it's for direct primary care offices. They're calling it direct primary care. So there's actually a national database of thousands of doctor's offices that no longer take insurance because they're finding other ways to provide quality care that the patient can afford. And again, it's not affordable for most Americans yet, but it's a new model that is tailored for the patient's needs. And for the people that do it through us, it works really well. The cost ranges from $600 a year to $1,000 a year. $600 for a year. A lot of our patients say, wow, that's what I'm paying per month for my insurance. That doesn't do very much for me. So that's his basic model, and we can talk more about it at some point.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Any thoughts come to mind, Amy?
In response to what she's just talking about, yeah. You know, I hear that a lot from physicians since I've been out, especially as an advocate for universal single-payer healthcare. There's a group called PNHP of physicians that are actually leading the charge to get universal healthcare, specifically Medicare for All. because they want to be a doctor again. They're tired of the insurance company dictating what kind of care, what level of care, what they can prescribe, not prescribe, and the amount of insane amount of paperwork that goes behind just even filing claims. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about the cost of insurance across this country, so much of it is squandered on administrative. That's where the real cost savings in the Medicare for All plan, that's specifically in the House, you know, the HR 676, that's where that plays into effect. It would also save our government $17 trillion over 10 years. If we eliminate all this ridiculous amount of paperwork cost and CEO salaries of health insurance companies, and the list goes on and on. And the other thing that was brought to mind when we were talking about, you know, the opioids, I can't tell you how many parents in the support groups I've gone to for parents who have lost children, how many children they have been lost due to this epidemic. And the numbers are just staggering. You know, there is a place for opioids in the medical field for people who are in severe pain, you know, been in an accident or going through surgery. But we definitely need to be promoting alternatives for pain management so that we don't have the addiction rates that we have to opioids right now. They're destroying families and people's lives.
Amy, what's the pattern for children dying young from an opioid addiction? Is it literally the doctor prescribing something that the child became addicted to?
Some of the cases are that. They're also readily available on the streets, but some of them die specifically from opioids and from overdosing. But a lot of them have started out with opioids, couldn't get access to them any longer, and then they go to harder drugs like heroin.
I see. Yeah.
And we talk about that, you know, you hear people talking fictitiously that marijuana is the gateway drug, which it's not. It's, you know, right now, the main concern we should have in this country is opioids. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, we don't want to see people in pain. So we need to be able to have an alternative. And here we have a great alternative, which is not, you know, doesn't have an addiction rates to it that we have with opioids. Mm-hmm. So it just, to me, it makes logical sense that this is something that we should be putting money into. But then, you know, we have to, when we're talking about legalizing cannabis, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about what we see happening in the industry today, which is the barrier of entry for people to get, especially in Nevada here, to be able to, you know, have a part of that industry. You know, you shouldn't need $250,000 just to be able to open up your own dispensary. And also we see a disparity in entry levels for Black and Brown people. And they've been the ones most affected by the incarceration rates. And, you know, there's so much to this and it's so complex. And I really feel like going into 2018, everyone really needs to take a look at the candidates that they're choosing to back and make sure they have a candidate that's willing to address this holistically. Because this is a very, there's a lot of complexity to it right now. It's in the beginning stages of being formed. And what I don't want to see happen is that it's taken over by huge corporations again, right?
Yeah.
And that we're then again at the behest of these large corporations. And we definitely want to make sure that we keep the barrier of entry lower than what it is right now, because right now it's very difficult for individuals or people who are entrepreneurs that want to, who are experts in this and want to open up their own company. Mm-hmm. The barriers of entry are so high that a lot of people cannot afford to get in, and it's especially true when we speak about Black and Brown people, and they have been the people that have been the most discriminated against throughout this entire history of incarceration. We need to make that entry into that much better. And I think that people who are in jail should be prioritized for hiring.
Oh, I agree.
So there's a lot of things. We need to make sure that when we're electing people, when we're standing behind candidates, that they're going to be candidates that are going to approach the cannabis issue holistically, and that they're going to be educated on all the nuances so that we have a just industry and that we are really looking out for everyone and not just turning it over to large corporations.
We'll be right back with today's panel. Farmer Adam and I were talking the other day about how far the cannabis movement has come since we first started working together in the name of building an understanding about the options Americans should have for holistic medicine, regardless of how doghouse it's been made by propaganda. We began in 2008 with documentary equipment and 8 years later decided our collective knowledge would be best seen and heard through podcasts. This week I write about it in an essay that I'll post on Medium, the online magazine journal. I'll be sure to put the link on Twitter. If you'd ever like to donate any amount to the Cannabis Corner, just text CBD to 555-888. That's CBD to 555-888. And remember, even if cannabis isn't for you, we believe it is for someone you care about. And now back to our panel.
Yeah, I just don't see how that is not going to happen. It seems inevitable to me that large corporations are going to take over. You know, here in Colorado, our market is ahead of many of the other states because of the early start that we got. And we're seeing a whole lot of that here. You know, I worked for a company that buys up dispensaries, you know, like they're just groceries at the grocery store. And, you know, it starts to become a monopoly. And so I don't see how that's going to be avoided with capitalism in the state of it today. You know, it's in addition that on a state-by-state basis, there's different rules and laws in each state as well, because this is, you know, still federally illegal and a Schedule I substance. So I would love to see that be the case. I would love for it to be that in Colorado, you don't have to have, you know, $500,000 in order to start a cannabis business. But that is, you know, the nature of things. And then the other a negative thing about cannabis being legalized that we've seen here and people are seeing in other places, I'm sure you are where you're at, is that property values start to go up and you have poor people who are driven out and you have more gentrification and people can't afford to live places like here in Fort Collins. I know so many people who cannot afford to live here anymore because wages have not kept up with the cost of living, and prices went up as cannabis became legal because people were, you know, coming here like crazy and wanting to get in on it or work in it, and that actually drove wages down as well because people from out of state were coming in willing to work for, you know, very little money. And all of this has affected things in a negative way, actually, from an economic perspective. And so I fear that, and I don't see what's going to stop that snowball from rolling down the hill.
I wanted to ask Sarah, because a lot of things have been coming up lately about the, you know, gateway drug and how easy it is to say. And I think part of the stigma is from the fear of it just being a step to worse drugs. And obviously, it's very, very simple to get those worse drugs. And the other thing that comes up is it's not a gateway. It's anything but, in how it satiates the patient in various ways from this entourage effect. What can you take from it that's going to make you feel better and not need something else? And over again, cannabis is proven to be enough so that someone could avoid the side effects of pharma, so that someone could avoid what it is their doctor is recommending. Sarah Payan, will you weigh in on that in your practice and in the people that you're seeing? Do you see anyone taking this to a place that is negative? Is there a person who takes cannabis and is unable to do anything but go to worse things with it? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I guess what I would say is that from a harm reduction standpoint, it really does. It has helped get a lot of people off of benzos and opiates. And some patients still need to use their opiates, but they don't need to use as much using THC in conjunction. That being said, you know, though cannabis isn't physically addictive, we can become psychologically addicted to a lot of things. I had a patient who came in a couple years ago with a syringe of concentrate that he had been smoking, and he was really frustrated because he said, "Sarah, this isn't getting me high anymore, and I used cannabis to get off of hard drugs."
I see.
And so that's when I looked at him, and I was just very honest, and I said, "This is a larger discussion about the hole that you're trying to fill, and are you getting help, the help that you need?" In that case, it's not about the cannabis, it's about we as human beings striving for homeostasis, and there's a disconnect. And what are we doing as a society to support people in this?
I think that's a very important point you just made in that one other stigma that seems to be rising very timely is men saying, I've been depressed, men saying, I have anxiety, or, you know, it's not okay. You have to be tough. You have to be striving to be the quintessential man without telling us about that. And there's just no way, there's no bridge from that to cannabis to what Sarah just said, and that is, if you're going to hit a wall and say to yourself, this isn't strong enough, what a good question to ask next. What's going on with you? Perhaps there's, you know, analytic theory, Freudian theory would suggest, you know, what's your story? So if you're going to be self-aware and look for places of harmony, human harmony, which we are all hoping for all people, be very aware that there are places you can get caught up that have nothing to do with other people and have to do with your specific story. So in some sense, cannabis and the different forms can be enough, but of course, we are all different. Danielle, you were saying something before we got started to Amy. What were you saying?
So since 2014, I had a company called THC Staffing Group. The person I co-founded chapters in college with, we had the normal chapter that Josh mentioned, but also Students for Sensible Drug Policy. So my background since 2001 as a college student is that Shalene Teitel and I have been completely focused on the social justice aspect of this. And she and I have been involved in different kinds of work in the industry. Around 2010, she was one of the lead attorneys on the legalization campaign in Colorado. And that's when she said, you know, we really need to start something of our own as soon as possible, because we need to be involved in making sure the social justice aspects of this don't get lost in this industry. And 2010 was really when we kept hearing the word industry everywhere, and we could no longer reject that label. If we wanted to continue with the social justice work, we had to embrace the industry and figure out our place in it and how to help steer it so that we didn't get lost in all the corporate bureaucracy and everything that Amy was mentioning earlier. So Shalene and I decided to start THC Staffing Group to work with companies who want to create a more inclusive industry. So a lot of the things we've been talking today about, the barrier to entry and the fact that a lot of people coming out of incarceration have something on their background that prevents them from working in the industry, for instance, in Colorado, which is just so ironic and terrible. So just last year in 2017, Shalene had to resign from our company because she was appointed by the governor of Massachusetts to the 5-person cannabis commission. So she's one of 5 commissioners there. She is one of the people who wrote the law that she's now working on implementing. So she's designing the way that the state of Massachusetts will implement adult use legalization. So it's really powerful. A lot of people in our movement are really inspired that someone like her, who's been an activist for 15 years, is now working directly as part of the state government to implement an equitable industry there. It's really exciting. And the work she's doing is already influencing other states. Not only is she trying to keep up with the Massachusetts deadlines, she's traveling and speaking with people in other jurisdictions that want to do what Massachusetts is doing. I don't think we have time to get into the details of it today, but there's a lot of details that go into what does an equitable industry look like? What can the government do to help guarantee that? Places in California are doing it. We've heard about Oakland, San Francisco. All of this is just getting started, but a little bit of work on that can quickly spread to other states. So I feel really hopeful about that. And activists, you know, working in the government, and like you, Amy, running for government office is so important and so powerful for every social justice issue. But I feel that with cannabis policy reform, it's a really focused way for us to influence the entire society. Like, every social justice issue, every problem in society is somehow related to our cannabis prohibition, and we have to fix that to be able to fix anything else.
Thoughts, Amy, on that?
You know, just that we need to, you know, and just to sum up what everyone else has been saying, it's mm-hmm. a lot of great information here. Mm-hmm. that I think the number one thing is to definitely get people not only that are in office and fighting it legislatively, but also using their platform to educate people within their district and by extension across the United States, the facts surrounding cannabis, and start taking away some of the stereotypes that are surrounding the whole issue. We have a lot of people that can really benefit. We have a lot of injustice surrounding cannabis historically that we need to have restorative justice on. We need to be really working on this issue. And someone who's willing to work with all the different organizations that have spent decades preparing for this moment in time that we're at, where we see that finally we're getting those doors open in state by state, and really push it now to go into a federal level so we can start having more concrete data and make sure that when we are having legislation that it's just across the board to everyone that is wanting to enter this industry. And that's very important to me. So I'm really appreciative you had me come on to speak today, and I look forward to speaking with you guys further.
We are so grateful to have you on, Amy Villela of Nevada. And how is your bid going? Are you having a pretty good run?
Yes, we have a lot of momentum running a true grassroots progressive campaign. We've knocked on over 6,000 doors, and we're making tens of thousands of phone calls every week. And we really are, you know, hitting the ground running. People are very excited to have an option to just the status quo. And that's what my campaign offers. I come from a place of authenticity, and people are ready. They're ready for true change.
When is the primary, Amy?
The primary is June 12th. Early voting begins the end of May. So we're less than 90 days out. And definitely, if anybody wants to find out more about my campaign, you can go to amyforthepeople.com. You can like, share, volunteer, and donate. We're definitely making some strides here, and it's a very good outlook as far as getting a true progressive in the office here in Nevada.
That's really exciting.
Amy, if you need any help educating in Nevada, let me know.
I will definitely take you up on that.
Yeah, please do.
Oh, that sounds great. I want to thank Sarah Pion. I want to thank Daniel Schumacher. I want to thank Amy Villela, who is running for Congress in Nevada's 4th District. Thank you so much, and I would love to have all of you back on as this unfolds, because you just let a month or two go by and the cannabis industry offers some new truth. I think we're all on the same page. People deserve to have this option, and they deserve to have options that are not always permitted to them just because of where they live. Adam, do you have more questions?
Yeah, I mean, I did have some more questions. One of them actually isn't cannabis related for Amy, but I was wondering what your thoughts were on universal income. Is that something that you back?
Yeah, so universal income is one of those issues that the overall thought process behind it, I'm definitely, you know, I really like, but I see it being a very vulnerable legislation as far as it will be included in items that are not, that are discretionary. So I could see them attacking that and saying, well, we have UBI, so now we don't need any of the other social programs that we have. So I'm more in favor of a federal jobs guarantee and making sure that we have full employment and that, and making sure we have robust social programs that we can take care of people and make, because, you know, that's one thing I could see them really attacking on the discretionary funds, is they would go directly to that. It'd be under constant attack.
And then I have another question, which is, do you think that insurance companies should be covering the cost of medical cannabis for patients?
As long as we have insurance companies, yes. I would like to do away with insurance companies, but yes, I do believe that. And I would love to see that included in Medicare for All.
And some of them are starting to cover it. We've seen for Dr. Lucido's patients, especially kids, mm-hmm. for some reason. I think there must be different programs that supplement coverage. And some mm-hmm. some insurance companies don't ask so many questions. It depends on who your employer is. If your employer has negotiated a group plan where they just kind of cover without asking for a lot of details. So flex spending accounts, health savings accounts, but also just regular types of insurance where the group plan is a little more lenient. So it is happening. Yeah, we need it for everybody, but it's starting to happen.
I think your biggest threat as an industry right now really is the pharmaceutical companies. And this, you know, and everybody says, well, you know, not everything is political, but it is. And one of the main things and what's going to help the cannabis industry the most is making sure that across this nation that we get people elected that are not beholden to the pharmaceutical industries. They, for their own selfish reasons, based on money, do not want to see anything happen with cannabis in a medical field at all. And so we're going to have to fight really hard against that influence. They're a powerful lobbying industry, and they have their money lining the pockets of many of our politicians. So that's something I'm looking forward to taking on. They're not on my top list of favorite people either. So I am ready, you know.
You go get them, Amy.
I tell you,
it's a sad thing when people in Section 8 housing are allowed to be addicted to opiates, but will lose their homes for medicating with cannabis.
Right.
It's absolutely crazy.
Or drug testing. We didn't talk about that in the workplace. Mm-hmm. The discrimination on that. There's so much, you know, with my husband being, he's in the military. He's one of the very few people that are on the left in the military. But the one thing that we see constantly is PTSD. You know, we need to be able to have that. I mean, they'll lose their veterans benefits if they test positive for cannabis. So there's so much to it. And that's why I was saying earlier in the podcast that we need to make sure that we are electing people that are going to look at this holistically. It's not just enough to say, yes, I support cannabis. They need to be educated and really willing to go to bat for it on many different levels.
Yeah, we have a colleague, Ryan
Miller.
Ryan Miller. Yeah. And in the years that he's been doing that project, he hasn't lost one vet to suicide.
Which is saying a great deal, because PTSD is certainly something that can lead to something as horrible as that. And Ryan, a veteran, is an activist for all soldiers of all types to have access. It mm-hmm. surprises me so much that an American veteran could lose their benefits for having cannabis on their record, or someone snitched and said, this soldier is using this. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to note that some people's opinion of cannabis is an immediate decision to make the person a criminal or an outlaw. When mm-hmm. when we all sit here, there's an incredible web of education to be had that connects families, children, the elderly, freedom, civil rights, expungements. It goes on and on. Then you mention PTSD. Then you mention great option for those made nauseous by radiation or chemo. It doesn't end. And Cheech and Chong isn't even on our list. you know, you can the decision from certain people on how they feel about this as medicine is as quick as that's stupid, like Cheech and Chong, or that, you know, how dare you bring up something that was illegal in high school into the conversation about the opioid crisis. Well, we have news for you. The truth is not always everybody's favorite, and it has to be heard, and it is being heard. So the work is being done. Our frustrations are not over. All right, why don't we call it a show, and we can all come back together and discuss how things are unfolding. Thank you again, Amy. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We'll be watching you. We'll be watching you on
TV. I hope you are.
We're going to be watching you
not
on TV, lady.
Yeah, best of luck to you and your campaign, Amy. Really wish you the best.
Thank you so much. I'm going to keep fighting.
Yeah, keep fighting. Such an informative show with so much important language. Farmer Adam and I are so grateful to you for listening and for sharing a message that taps into human rights, civil rights, the elderly, the ill, and those who don't yet know they are ill. Let's keep up this dialogue so as to help people we don't need to know personally to care about. And we'll see you next time on the Cannabis Corner.